This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Thursday, February 15th, 2018. I'm Caleb Brown. The Nunez memo has landed, alleging abuses in the process of securing surveillance warrants on at least one member of the Trump campaign team. It may not have presented a strong case that the process was abused, but it's still worth looking into how the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court does its job. Cato Senior Fellow Julian Sanchez joined me yesterday in a live online Cato Connects discussion. This is a portion of our conversation. Right before this memo was released, Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell went out and talked a little bit about this memo. And this is something that I found pretty notable is what Paul Ryan said here.
What this memo is Congress doing its job in conducting legitimate oversight over a very unique law, FISA. And if mistakes were made and if individuals did something wrong, then it is our job as the legislative branch of government to conduct oversight over the executive branch if abuses were made. Remember, FISA is a unique situation which involves Americans' civil liberties. And if Americans' civil liberties were abused, then that needs to come to light so that that doesn't happen again. What this is not is an indictment on our institutions, of our justice system. This memo is not an indictment of the FBI, of the Department of Justice. It does not impugn the Mueller investigation or the Deputy Attorney General.
All right, that's Paul Ryan sort of discussing before the release of the Nunez memo. This is about civil liberties. This is about the House doing its proper oversight function to make sure that civil liberties are not violated. First of all, what did the Nunez memo allege with respect to civil liberties of the people who had been targeted?
Sure. So the central claim of the Nunez memo really was about an allegation that the FBI had misled the FISA court. So just imagine if you're watching this, you probably are familiar with the background to some extent. But we've confirmed that Carter Page, who had been an advisor on energy policy and foreign policy to Donald Trump as a candidate, had left the campaign after some controversy was raised over his ties to Russia. And then after leaving, a FISA warrant was obtained to wiretap him and renewed it, I believe, on three separate occasions, at least that we know of. So he was surveilled for essentially a year shortly after leaving the campaign. The allegation in the Nunez memo, and this is the main substantive one, is that the wiretap application was based essentially, I think is the language they used, on a dossier compiled by former MI6 agent Christopher Steele, who was doing essentially opposition research commissioned by the research firm Fusion GPS, which had been paid by the Democratic National Committee and the Clinton campaign to compile information about Trump's potential ties to the Russian government. And so the allegation in the Nunez memo is that there's really actually a couple of separate allegations. One of them is more of an insinuation. So the insinuated part is that the application rested almost entirely on this dossier, the findings of this dossier. And it's further insinuated, though not really said exactly, that those allegations weren't corroborated in any meaningful way. But the sort of marquee claim is that the FBI concealed from the FISA court that this was not just some neutral former intelligence agents, but someone who had been hired at least indirectly by the Democratic National Committee to conduct opposition research. That central claim has not fared very well. Democrats immediately responded, was effectively confirmed in a letter that was declassified by written by Senators Grassley and Graham, is that in fact there is a footnote that references that this was a politically funded and politically motivated document. People say, well, but why didn't they say, you know, the Democratic National Committee specifically? And the answer that's also made pretty clear from the Grassley and Graham letter is because there are no specific names in the application other than Carter Page's, as far as we can tell. It's pretty clear from some quotations in the Grassley memo that Christopher Steele himself is not named or indeed even referred to with gendered pronouns. It's always he or she's research, or his or her research. The CEO of Fusion GPS is referred to as an identified U.S. person. This is pretty common in intelligence. There's a practice called minimization, which means that even for internal use within the government, you essentially omit the specific names and identifying information of U.S. persons, and in the case of Steele, apparently also even British persons, when that's not essential to understand the intelligence. So there's, I heard it suggested at one point that even Trump is effectively only identified as U.S. presidential candidate, which seems not like a meaningful obscuring. But I think in this case too, judges on the FISA court understood, A, what was the relevant thing, which is that this is a politically financed document. And
Take it with a grain of salt.
Take it with however much salt that entails. But then also, they probably could figure out who Carter Page was from the newspaper and put together who was likely to be funding opposition research on Donald Trump.
All right. So the concern that Paul Ryan articulates here is civil liberties, and in not – or at least the allegation that this application for surveillance was hiding something or right. prevent or not revealing some things that it was known to be relevant to the discussion. I guess why doesn't that then extend to everyone else?
Right. No, that's a great question. I mean, I want to separate two questions. Republican Ryan here, I think, is maybe an extreme example of this, of an attempt to, on the one hand, say this is really a principled concern with civil liberties, but also in a sense to hermetically seal it and say, but this has nothing to do with any of the larger institutions of the FISA court or the FBI or the Justice Department. And that's not really tenable, I think, if you understand how FISA works in any detail. This is why I think you want to segregate really two distinct questions. One question is, was there adequate evidence in this memo to justify wiretapping an American citizen, and perhaps with whatever added sensitivity we want to and scrutiny we want to attach to a case where there's potential for political abuse, where the target is a former advisor to a presidential campaign? That's one question. We probably don't have enough information to answer it yet. The second question is there compelling evidence that the FBI did something extraordinary or underhanded in this particular case? Basically, all of the attempts to make a kind of bad apples argument here and say it's not the FISA court, it's not any of these institutions, but there was some cabal of bad people who broke the rules and lied to the court and got an order they shouldn't have. Those arguments, to my mind, have not fared very well at all. Nevertheless, I think there's a legitimate question of, okay, how much more was in this application than effectively hearsay compiled by an opposition researcher? And if the answer is not a lot, which may or may not be the case, we can say maybe a little bit more of that in a second. But if it turns out that the Steele dossier without corroboration was the bulk of it, that I think would be legitimately concerning, and one could legitimately say that doesn't seem like a good enough basis to wiretap an American citizen for 3 months, which is the initial phase of a FISA order. But then you can't make the bad apples argument, right? If the claim is not the FBI did something aberrant, they lied to the FISA judges, but instead, the FISA court was fully informed, but they granted a warrant we don't think they should have, then you have to ask, all right, that's one FISA order. Probably, realistically, it got a lot more scrutiny and close attention than, an average FISA order, given the sensitivity of the target. And so if nevertheless that was approved on grounds that when we have enough information we think were inadequate, you can't segregate that from questions about the institutions. Is the FISA court an effective check? Are the many, many layers of review that application would have had to go through a meaningful check? Civil libertarians complain about lots of intelligence tools, but the part of FISA, Title I of FISA, these targeted surveillance orders approved by the secret court, it's not that there are no problems with the process, but this is the part of FISA that civil libertarians tend to have the fewest problems with and kind of speak up about the least, because it's the one that looks most like a kind of traditional criminal investigative warrant process. And so if the surveillance tool with the most oversight, where there's not just the FISA court, there's multiple layers of review within FBI, there's these fairly exacting Woods procedures, as they're called, carried out by attorneys in the National Security Division at the Department of Justice, if that most hedged in with safeguards part of FISA is still yielding extensive surveillance that in the light of day doesn't look justified, you can't say this has no implications for our institutions. You have to assume that things, in a sense, can only be worse in the tools that are less hedged with safeguards.
All right. A question here from Johnson3000. Thank you for the question here. What are the big takeaways from the Nunez memo, and will its release have any effect on the investigations as they move forward?
Right. It's hard to say. I think there's been a as we are perhaps accustomed to now, a kind of divergence in the reactions to the Nunez memo. My sense is, by and large, and without clear partisan dividing lines here, people who are national security experts and experts in FISA law looked at the Nunez memo and said, there's just not a whole lot there. Certainly not anything that would support a claim of radical impropriety or some kind of willful conspiracy.
Or at least impropriety that is outside the normal range of impropriety.
Right, exactly. I mean, it's a low bar, but if the claim is, right, this is some extraordinary case where the FBI went outside of its normal practice, there's not a lot of evidence there. But that doesn't mean it's not being sort of regarded as explosive proof by media outlets that are friendly to the president. So there's the likelihood that, like so many other news events, it's going to play in a kind of bifurcated way as it goes forward. But the consensus has been interestingly sharp. I mean, there's Republican Orrin Kerr, for example, was a professor at Georgetown Law, is now in California, I think at UCLA. Paul Rosenzweig, was a scholar at Heritage for a long time, have all sort of written publicly that they don't really see a lot of there here. So the long-term impact, part of the question is, what is the point? What is it supposed to accomplish? If the goal is give Republicans cover with their constituents so that when Donald Trump fires Bob Mueller and Rod Rosenstein, who's Mueller's supervisor at the Justice Department, the constituents are sort of fine with that and think they're purging the deep state conspiracy. So Republicans feel okay not saying much or pushing back. It might well succeed at having that effect. I think a lot is going to depend on what happens with the Democratic response. When that is, as I imagine it will be, ultimately released in some unredacted form. I think, again, on the was there a strange conspiracy question, that argument's not faring very well. You have the residual question of, all right, but was there enough evidence to justify this order? And that's more up in the air. What we know is it was one of the sticking points in the Democratic response is that there are supposedly 47 different items that the FBI has asked them to redact. Unless they're just sort of arbitrarily disclosing classified facts, that seems to suggest there's more in the application. There's more evidence pertaining to how the FBI secured that order from the FISC than it was just a Steele dossier, which is now public.
So if you have a question for Julian Sanchez on the Nunez memo, the Grassley letter, and our high secret courts in the federal government, you can tweet those using the hashtag CatoConnects, and we'll get to those as soon as we can. One question here from Sahil Desai. Mm-hmm. If the FISA process is so flawed, why did the GOP help reauthorize it? Now, they didn't help reauthorize it. They reauthorized it, right?
So, I mean, again, I will say the Title I FISA process is the least flawed one, right? Again, you probably, if you kind of look through things I've written about surveillance, you will probably not see me objecting that loudly to these targeted warrants. I think there's questions to raise about them, but that's not the part of the process people tend to think is most seriously flawed. But the question is a good one. What the Republicans reauthorized recently, indeed just very shortly before the defense of the Nunes memo, was Section 702. This is a different part of FISA. It's a Title 7 of FISA, which is about warrantlessly targeting foreigners, but also on a very large scale, but compiling a huge database of their internet communications that can then subsequently be searched by intelligence officials, which means maybe you don't need to go through the process and jump through the hoops required to directly wiretap an American citizen if you can get what you need by targeting their foreign contacts. Technically not supposed to do that, but it's hard to sort of determinatively show someone's intent in targeting a foreign party, and then comb through the database looking for that person's name or identifying information. And so you would think, okay, well, this is a warrantless process that can still be used to query for American communications. If you are worried about abuse of the more rigorous Title I process, where there's individualized judicial oversight, wouldn't you have even more concerns for what had been done with the less regulated surveillance process?
Because we know more about this application than perhaps any other application that has ever been presented to the court.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is by far more detail than we've ever had about a FISA application. Until, I think, about 2003, there had never been any opinion of the FISA court that had been made public. And so between 2002 and 2013, I believe there were two FISA court opinions that were made public for the first time. And this is a court that's existed since 1979. This was sort of unprecedented. And then since the Snowden disclosures, the government has, I suppose to its credit, become really significantly more transparent. There are now dozens of FISA court opinions that are on the public record, but a FISA application has never, to the best of my knowledge, been made public. And so there's discussion now about whether settling this means we need to get some redacted version of the original underlying application. If that happened, it would be the first time ever. There's two questions that it's reasonable to ask. One is if you have issues with how this application was supported. We've never seen any other applications. Is that unusual? Was it better or less well supported than the other, 1,500 plus FISA applications that are sought and granted every year? And I think in 2016, there were about 1,485 FISA orders, and a little over 300 were targeting American citizens or permanent legal residents. Is the basis for their targeting more robust than what's in the PAGE application? That's one question to ask. And then again, the other is, right, why would you be worried about this Title I authority that does have many layers of oversight and judicial approval, and then at the same time, I'm talking literally about individually, Devin Nunes here, say, we don't need any reform of this warrantless authority. We don't need any additional protections, which Justin Amash had proposed, to require a warrant before that vast database of intercepted communications can be searched for an American's emails or chats. You saw the same people who are now talking about a deep state, politically motivated conspiracy to target Trump during that debate saying, well, why would we need reform? Why would we need extra protections? This authority has never been abused, as we know, because the deep state cabal told us it's never been abused. It is difficult to reconcile those two beliefs. You would, at the one hand, think you have very compelling evidence of some necessarily very far-reaching conspiracy, given the multiple layers of internal review before an application gets to the FISA court, and then at the same time, you can trust assurances that that other less well-guarded powers are being used appropriately.
Right. So you've written that, unfortunately, the way that this has played out, it has become perhaps less likely to get reform of these kinds of authorities.
Mm-hmm.
And yet in public media, we're hearing more about the FISC, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, than we've ever heard before, like ever. So how reconcile those two things if you think this thing is going to harm efforts to try to get reform in that area?
Right. No, I mean, look, that may well be healthy. I mean, be a healthy development just to raise public awareness of the FISC and start people asking questions like, you mean a secret court can order a wiretap on me and I would never hear about it? But I think there's a couple problems. One is just anything that becomes essentially partisanized becomes a less useful or a fruitful debate, right? Civil liberties are an issue where you actually see an interesting level of kind of bipartisan action in both directions. You have Democrats who are very friendly to the intelligence agencies and tend to support broader sort of post 9/11 war on terror surveillance powers, and you have Republicans who break from the majority of their caucus to support reform and try and constrain their ability to spy. If it becomes sort of a party line issue, I think you have less useful room for maneuver there. And indeed, I think we're seeing Democrats in a way almost hedge themselves in, not just saying, the case presented here is not particularly compelling, but how outrageous to question the FBI and the FISA court and it's just absurd to suggest that these patriots would ever politically misuse that authority. Well, of course we know there's a long history of political misuse of not these particular surveillance authorities, but of the FBI and NSA and CIA's power to spy. So I think it would be unfortunate in a way, right, if crying wolf on this issue ends up discrediting the absolutely legitimate concern that these are extremely broad powers. They are unusual in our constitutional system, and that history suggests that they are very likely to be abused if they're not overseen quite rigorously.
So your argument then is the hype and the hype that sort of failed in terms of the allegations made here may, in a sense, inoculate the intelligence community against a sort of a deeper look at how they do what they do.
That's right. I mean, if the sort of the takeaway once enough information is out that there can be, to the extent that it is ever possible in America now, a kind of broad consensus about what was proven and what wasn't, to the extent the conclusion is, all right, these allegations of abuse, these claims that people's civil liberties were imperiled by FISA tools was essentially a stunt, was something ginned up for partisan advantage to try and discredit an investigation of a Republican president. I think that makes it harder to get people to take seriously the claims that just for policy reasons we should be worried about those things, not because we're trying to protect Donald Trump, because those are things legitimately worth worrying about.
So let's get into what the FISC actually does. Where did this court come from and why was it believed to be necessary when it was created?
Right. People occasionally say, well, FISA, isn't that terrible? It creates this secret court. And I say, well, but it's a lot better than what we had before. The FISA court originates from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act of 1978. The court itself was constituted the following year. And it was really a response to the discovery via the Church Committee, as a Senate committee headed by Senator Frank Church, that investigated the conduct of the intelligence community over the preceding several decades and found a pretty chilling pattern of systematic political abuse of surveillance authorities, not limited just to electronic surveillance, but infiltration, disinformation, various forms of harassment of political adversaries of administrations, of activists, either feminist or anti-war, in particular, often black nationalist activists, and then more mainstream civil rights leaders. Most famously, certainly not exclusively, we learned from this that J. Edgar Hoover, as part of a program called COINTELPRO, had subjected Martin Luther King to an extensive system of surveillance, including capturing him in his motel rooms, having sex with women he wasn't married to. These were essentially later compiled into a highlight reel that was sent to his home as part of an effort to his allies believed drive him into depression and perhaps suicide in the months before he was to receive the Nobel Peace Prize. That's maybe the most dramatic example, but part of a much larger pattern of political abuse. And so having for decades essentially allowed the intelligence community to treat itself as outside the bounds of both the general Fourth Amendment rules and federal statutes governing criminal investigations and wiretaps in criminal inquiries. Those are under usually called Title III of the Omnibus Crime Control Act of 1968. It was observed that judicial oversight was really pretty clearly necessary for intelligence surveillance as well. And so the FISA court was created to really for the first time regulate the intelligence community's use, at least within the United States, of surveillance technology. Outside the United States, shortly after the passage of FISA, the community effectively got a charter for the first time when Ronald Reagan signed off on an executive order known as Executive Order 12333 that set some much weaker limits on how the intelligence agencies could conduct themselves outside the borders of the United States. But the FISA court's job was to ensure that there was some judicial oversight of targeted surveillance domestically. And there were some slightly complex different standards depending on whether the target of surveillance was a U.S. person or a foreign person. But in both cases, the court would be required to agree that there was probable cause to believe that the person targeted was an agent of a foreign power. And the definition of who counts as a foreign agent was a bit more stringent for for Americans than it was for foreigners. But for its first decades, really it was doing the ordinary work of a court that approves applications for individualized wiretaps. It was making assessments of evidentiary adequacy and showings of probable cause with respect to particular persons and particular communications facilities that were going to be surveilled. It's hard to know exactly how to read this, but for the first couple decades of its existence, the FISA court effectively approved every application that was put before it. It's hard to say whether this is because the court was a rubber stamp or because the agencies were just so rigorous about what they chose to submit to the court.
And why do we not know that?
Because no one has ever seen a FISA application before. Folks from the intelligence community always say, no, the approvals are so high because there's a back and forth process that doesn't show up in just a question of whether something was approved or not. They will send things back and say, this isn't quite strong enough. Why don't you narrow it and maybe leave some people out of the application and only target these folks? Or why don't you come back to us with a little bit more substantiating information? And then an application might be withdrawn. And so the rejections, they claim, don't show the full story. I think that's probably true to some extent. I think also probably the court is inclined to be pretty deferential to the intelligence agencies when they make assertions about, who they have concluded in their professional expertise is probably a foreign spy, when effectively this is going to be permanently secret. Right? It's not like if you approve an application that's weakly supported, this is going to come out when the higher court sort of slaps you down, when all this comes out, when the target is brought to trial. You're only hearing essentially from one side, and you don't have to worry that if you're too lenient in the approval, this is going to come out when ultimately the target is indicted and you have discovery obligations and their lawyers get to go picking through these things and seeing whether the warrant was appropriate. So, you know, I think both the incentives and sort of the sociology of it, right? These are the people you're hearing from every day. They're telling you how important it is to stop these national security threats would tend to bias the court in favor of deference to their conclusions. So I think, you know, probably both are true to some extent, but it's hard to know what the balance is without actually being able to directly assess the sort of the underlying material. The FISA court, I think, has probably been overextended to some extent, at least since 9/11, if not before. So, you know, by the time we hit the 21st century, the court has gone from 7 to 11 judges, all appointed by Chief Justice John Roberts, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, whoever that is, but at present, all the sitting FISA judges were appointed by John Roberts, and have really gone beyond their sort of initial mandate of making these kind of individualized decisions. As we've learned, you know, in significant part as a result of the Edward Snowden disclosures, they are often now in the position of deciding whether various kinds of programmatic surveillance are consistent with the broader set of statutory tools orbiting FISA, and so you know you have questions like, all right, well, you've got this this authority to get business records and documents. It's supposed to require that the records you obtain are relevant to an investigation. Can you get entire databases of information, like everyone's phone records, and then claim that's relevant because going through the entire database will let you find the specifically relevant records? The court seemed to think that was all right. It accepted a similar argument as it pertained to bulk collection of international internet metadata from the internet backbone. Seems to approved, I would say, you know, a number of practices that go beyond questions about have you shown this person as a foreign agent, that you know, raise more questions as to whether this is the kind of decision, not a decision about evidence in a particular case, but decisions about how these rather powerful intelligence tools will be interpreted. Is there going to be a secret body of common law effectively defining the scope of intelligence powers that is, I think, a lot more questionable than whether you've got a secret court that's only making these more individualized determinations. And even there, I think, again, there's a kind of a problem over time of a bias towards deference. And so, you know, it might be preferable to have a different process there, although some recent reforms have tried to counteract that to some extent by creating a series of amici, basically outside experts to argue before the court and present either technical or legal perspectives that the government itself might not find itself motivated to offer as to why a particular kind of surveillance might not be acceptable.
Right. So you make mention of the applications, the attorneys who work for the government go before these judges with their applications. Sometimes those might be – the judges might say, well, look, let's make some changes here and then we'll approve it. But there's no other side, right?
That's right.
As you just described, there's no other attorney saying, now hold on a second.
Right. And that's – as you say, that is normal for wiretap applications. You don't have another side when you're applying for a wiretap, even in a criminal investigation, because it defeats the purpose if you announce to the lawyer. Right. What matters, I think, is eventually there's going to be another side. And if the judge is sort of granting everything that's put before them, that's something that's going to get challenged when that wiretap evidence is introduced in a prosecution. Because the point of Title III criminal wiretaps is to generate evidence to use in trial and to make criminal cases. The point of FISA is not to make criminal cases, and it's essentially understood way back in the legislative history that in the normal case, the target of FISA surveillance would never learn of it and would never be brought to court over it. You know, very often we're talking about foreign agents who come in and out and probably aren't going to be tried here, in part because you don't want to expose sources and methods, and it's geared towards gathering useful information, not necessarily about making criminal cases. There are procedures for the use of FISA intercept information in criminal trials, of course, but the actual frequency of that happening is quite low. Of the, again, you know, sort of 1,500 to 1,000 to 2,000 orders issued annually, it's extremely rare for more than a couple to ever make their way into the inside of a court.
So you mentioned that we have referred in at a couple of moments to the Grassley memo, and you say that's it's more important than the Nunez memo. It pokes some holes in some arguments that were presented there. What was the main thrust of that that discussion?
So Senators Grassley and Graham sent a letter to the FBI that was recently released in a more fully declassified form. And their primary focus was – well, their nominal focus was a criminal referral to the FBI suggesting that Steele might have lied to the FBI about the extent of his contacts with the media about the investigation. I think – so realistically, you have to understand this: the true function of this as not really a criminal referral. Right, the FBI is aware of any information that was brought to their attention by the senators, and the odds that they're going to attempt to criminally prosecute a British citizen over misstatements about the extent of media contacts are slim. So you sort of have to infer that the purpose of this is not really the hopes of securing a criminal prosecution against Christopher Steele. It's more, again, about sort of highlighting questions about the FBI's process. So, you know, part of the question raised there is, all right, well, are there reasons the FBI should have been more qualified in its assessments of Steele's credibility? In sort of using findings from his research as the basis for – or a basis anyway for this application. So on the one hand, as I sort of mentioned earlier, it sort of accidentally kind of blows a hole in the core claim of the Nunez memo. It makes it clear first that the FISA court was informed that this was politically motivated research, and second, it makes clear that the omission of the DNC specifically as the funder was not some – strange omission, attempt to hide something, but just part of a pattern of not naming U.S. persons in the application. But it also says more directly several things that Nunez actually kind of oddly and conspicuously only insinuates. Graham and Grassley say not just the Steele dossier was cited, but that it formed the bulk of the application. So that matters. It matters whether the Steele dossier was one piece of evidence among many others, or you know, the main show. And also they claim that it was not meaningfully corroborated, which again is important. You're not really hanging anything on your assessment of the credibility of Christopher Steele if you've checked the claims and they match up with a lot of other evidence you have from telecommunications records or bank records or other sources of information. If you haven't meaningfully corroborated it, then it's a lot more questionable what the FISA court is doing, signing off on something that's effectively hearsay. I mean, part of the problem here is if what the FBI is doing is saying we've found Christopher Steele to be a credible source in the past, which he had been apparently to the Bureau, that's fine. Not necessarily illegitimate just because on this occasion you know, the checks are being cut by the DNC for his research. But fundamentally, Steele is reporting hearsay, right? It's not that Steele has direct knowledge of the things he's saying. He's rather reporting what his Russian sources have told him about Steele acting as a liaison, about some kind of collusion and electoral interference. And that's sort of a problem even if you think Steele is credible despite his funding sources, because what you're then saying is we think he's credible and therefore we're willing to extend credibility to claims he is reporting from other sources we don't have direct access to. If that's, you know, actually the picture, that's problematic.
It's pretty thin.
That would be thin. Again, we have a Democratic response that is undergoing declassification review, is supposed to have 47 items. It may turn out that there is much more to this application than either Nunes or Graham and Grassley imply or say. But Graham and Grassley was significant in that it directly addressed the question not of whether the Steele dossier as a whole had been verified. Right? Nunes made a great deal of James Comey saying that parts of the dossier were salacious and unverified, meaning salacious allegations about Donald Trump and prostitutes in a Moscow hotel. He had clearly not said in the testimony that was quoted, everything in the dossier is unverified, everything in the dossier is salacious. So that the Nunes memo tried to use this as its evidence that the dossier information was unverified rather than just directly saying the specific facts. There's only a few items in the dossier that really are about Carter Page. The specific facts cited in the FISA application, those facts were uncorroborated. That's the claim that matters if you want to say something went wrong with the process here. And so the fact that the Nunes memo relied on this not very convincing citation to James Comey, I think appropriately raised eyebrows. And so why aren't you making the claim that it's relevant? Graham and Grassley at least did make the claim. They did not meaningfully corroborate the Steele information upon which they relied.
But again, it seems like we're getting sort of pinholes here of what the truth is, right?
That's
the
right.
Nunes memo refers to a bunch of things that nobody has access to.
Right.
And you wonder whether or not Mr. Nunes has put together the best claim or if there's something preventing him from putting forward the
That's
best
right.
claim that he could be making.
Yeah. I think the Democratic response will give us a sense of legitimacy of this. Right? Essentially, right now, we're sort of going with what has been asserted. The most direct assertion, again, from Graham and Grassley is this dossier was the bulk of the application and the facts from the dossier that were cited weren't independently meaningfully corroborated. If we assume that that's an accurate characterization, I think that's a problem. Then the question becomes, okay, well, is that accurate? If the Democratic memo comes out and they say, actually, they forgot to mention these other, five sources that are part of the application and that aren't mentioned, even if they don't go into too much detail, and I would imagine they wouldn't, about what exactly the sources were, like there are good intelligence reasons. You would not want to tip Russian intelligence off to, specifically what sensitive information about their activities that you've got ways of gathering. But simply just at least knowing there's a bunch of other sources that are omitted from the characterization by Nunes and Grassley would, I think, reasonably lead us to treat that as less reliable. But we'll sort of see what they say. It may nevertheless come down to not really being able to judge this without looking at the underlying application itself. Again, it would be totally unprecedented for a FISA application to be made public in any way. But even if it had to be pretty substantially redacted, it might be useful. In a sense, just to look at the relative size of the blackout bars. If you see, okay, 5 pages or 10 pages of the Steele dossier, and then there's 10, 15 pages of supporting material that's got to be blacked out, that at minimum tells you there's other supporting evidence beyond the Steele dossier. And whether it's enough maybe is unknowable, but at least you can assess the claim that this is really centrally about the Steele dossier.
Jake asks a question. He says, we at Pogo Blog, that's the project on government oversight, says, our concern, this is a related issue, concerned about the news that ICE would like to become part of the intel community. What risks does that pose?
That seems like a I'm sorry. If you want to talk about law enforcement agencies, they're out of control. I think you have a reasonably good case for ICE falling into that category. And lots of law enforcement agencies can get forwarded pieces of intelligence that are relevant to their work. But I think it makes more sense for that to be a judgment call made by the intelligence agencies themselves, as it now is. So it's not that local law enforcement or the DEA or other agencies can't have access to information that the intelligence agencies obtain. It's just that the intelligence agencies essentially are making their own determination about when those other entities need to be looped in. And so to routinize direct access to this rather sensitive and enormous body of information and to be giving ICE sort of the go-ahead to kind of be participating in the process of choosing targets and tasking surveillance is I think, a particularly unwise idea, not least because there's kind of the perennial issue of mission creep. These are the FISA tools, right, differ significantly. Even Title I, which I said is the least problematic, the closest to ordinary criminal surveillance process, right, involves a lot broader authority and somewhat laxer legal thresholds than the criminal equivalent. And the reason the safeguards there are weaker, I mean, there are for foreign intelligence purposes, even under that Title I particularized surveillance process, the conditions under which a warrant can be issued are conditions that would not pass constitutional muster in a criminal court. It's because of the special needs of foreign intelligence, for example, that someone could get a 90-day wiretap on someone on the basis of evidence showing that they may be involved in conduct that would violate the law. You would not get that out of a criminal court or a court supporting a criminal investigation. But we're told the needs are different in the case of foreign intelligence for various reasons, and there's something to that. But the further you get from the sort of core use case of foreign spies trained in tradecraft and foreign terror groups that, again, have some semi-equivalent foreign support network and tradecraft training, and get more toward ordinary immigration enforcement or immigration enforcement plus other criminal laws like drug trafficking, the more questionable it becomes, the more you, I think, reasonably ask, why do you need these extraordinary and very flexible tools to spy as we get into territory that looks a lot more like ordinary criminal law enforcement?
Are we going to continue to see, if you're correct and reforming FISA is in a sense not on the table as much as it would have been even a couple of years ago, are we going to just continue to, I guess, see, or in this case, not really see potential abuses or misuse of these applications?
So I should hedge this. I mean, it depends, genuinely depends what we conclude as this plays out. So it may well turn out that, as I've suggested, the case for a FBI deep state conspiracy against Trump is not very good, but it turns out that the evidence that this is an awfully thin basis to wiretap an American citizen, that might well turn out to be the case. And if that is the case, that might well spur people to ask, all right, was this just Carter Page, or in general, these orders not getting the level of evidentiary support we think is adequate? And if that's true, what's going on with all the authorities where you don't even have particularized judicial oversight? That is an outcome I can see. And to the extent, again, that this refocuses folks on these authorities in advance, that may be helpful the next time the section of FISA, Section 702, the sort of warrantless foreign targeting authority, was just reauthorized. So that's in place for another 6 years. But we've got another year or two before the sections of the Patriot Act, including Section 215, which is the authority implicated in that Snowden disclosure involving bulk telephone record collection, are up for reauthorization again. So, the pattern in the past has very often been this is something that comes up right before the expiration date. There's not much interest in talking about the authorities. Ron Wyden says, I want some hearings. They give him, something to throw a bone.
Or they promise him hearings at some point in the future, right, and then never do it.
But essentially what happens is as they get to the expiration deadline, the drop dead date for renewing some of these expiring surveillance authorities, sort of the congressional leadership says, well, there's no time for a real debate. We'll have some sort of quick speeches, and but now we've got to just hurry up and vote, and there's no time to talk about reform. If instead this is something that's sort of in the zeitgeist, that people are attuned to at least the potential for misuse of these authorities, it may be more likely that attention is paid and a kind of process starts early enough that the kind of window of opportunity for reform is not sort of steamrolled through by the fake emergency of we waited until the last minute, now we've got to act.
Julian Sanchez is a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. Subscribe to and rate the Cato Daily Podcast at iTunes and Google Play. And follow us on Twitter at Cato Podcast.